clump of aluminum, chain, and wheels. "So, how the hell did you drive this thing into a phone booth anyway?" I laughed nervously. "Well, I just got into D.C. today," I said.
"No kidding. That makes two newbies in town," Trent said, slapping me on the back. "I moved here last month. Just graduated from College of Charleston. What brought you?"
I explained my story to Trent, my track record of failure and how it manifested itself as this failed quest to meet Professor Mallard. I even told him about the peculiar blonde girl who gave me her bike just a few hours earlier.
"Well, she wasn't that peculiar," I said. "She was insanely pretty and nice, like you."
"Fiora, that was her."
"Fiora Buchanan," Trent bellowed. "She's been up in Philly a lot lately."
"You know her?"
"Abso-freaking-lutely. She's about the only person I know in D.C. We were best friends growing up. Fiora's a couple of years younger than me, but our fathers did business together back in Charleston. Paper business." Trent froze.
"Wait a minute."
"What?"
He shook his head and started to laugh.
"What?"
I said louder, my voice cracking. This only intensified Trent's laughter.
"You must have biked through Washington Circle, didn't you? It's smack in the middle of Georgetown and GW, with a big old statue of George Washington, a bunch of students hanging out on the benches, philosophy types."
"I was coming from Georgetown, so probably."
"You, my accident-prone friend, were riding around on a stolen bike."
"Huh? No way."
"Yes, sir," he said. "She's always challenging herself like that, Fiora, doing risky shit for the hell of it. Last week, she told me she was stealing her TA's bike to teach him a lesson. They, have a rocky relationship." Trent let out a sigh. "I used to try and talk Fiora out of these things when we were kids, you know? But she is stubborn." If I had any interest in Fiora before as a cute girl, a stranger who briefly distracted me from the stakes of my running away, God damn it. I couldn't believe the man who chased me was her teacher. I couldn't believe I was riding his stolen bike. I was furious. I breathed heavily, clenching the bike's battered handlebar before throwing it to the ground.
"Do you think she was trying to screw me over or something?"
"Absolutely not," Trent said.
He looked simultaneously stern and sympathetic.
"You need to know something, Scout. Fiora's life these days is about as messed up as a bunch of lawmakers trying to do their damn jobs. She's going through some big changes with her family. Lord knows she's not the kind of girl to let the world get away with giving her a kick, so sometimes she'll kick back. Stealing that back, giving it away, these things give her a necessary thrill. Does that make sense?"
"It's still messed up," I said, "but whatever."
We dumped the remains of my bike into a garbage can, the aluminum frame and rubber wheels overflowing the top. Not to be outdone by Fiora, Trent insisted on walking me back to my hostel. The sun was glistening off the D.C. skyline, a fiery blitz of rays dancing along the shiny glass buildings around us. We passed important government agencies whose names were too convoluted to bother reading in full. The International Something Policy Something, the Federal Mediation and Something Else Center, among others.
"What's your background?" Trent asked.
"Persian," I said. "I mean, my parents are. I was born here."
"Is that the same thing as Iranian?"
I gulped, reminding myself that Trent grew up in the Deep South. My parents said that people there still think of Iran as an axis of evil, no thanks to President Bush.
"Yeah," I mumbled. "Dude, that's awesome. I didn't grow up around a lot of, diversity," Trent said.
Diversity was one of those buzzwords that always annoyed me, but Trent made it sound like an exciting taboo, something otherworldly.
"I did know a Middle Eastern guy in college. Afghan, I think. Do they speak the same language? Arabic?"
I smiled for a couple of reasons. The way he said words like diversity and Middle Eastern, Afghan and Arabic, Trent might as well have been speaking a foreign language. The juxtaposition of those words with his accent was like nothing I'd heard before. More important, though, his interest was genuine. Trent was looking to me as an expert, not an alien. and that felt uniquely special. Iranians and Afghans speak the same language, Farsi.
Farsi, Trent said fondly.
Right. My friend taught me to say something in Farsi.
Basanam dar mikone?
Something like that. I stopped in my place and fell to the ground laughing. I told Trent that the phrase his friend had taught him translated into my butt hurts. He crossed his arms and grumbled, saying, after that fall, I bet yours does too. Then he helped me up. I asked Trent what he was doing in D.C., and the rest of our walk home took the form of an episode of The West Wing, guest-starring future U.S. Senator Trent Worthington. I've been obsessed since I was a kid, he gushed. It's been my dream for as long as I can remember to get elected to Congress. Trent's hopeful gaze melted into reluctant cynicism when I asked how a person gets into politics in the first place. He complained that it was impossible to land a job in D.C. without the right connections, like being the daughter of a Kennedy or roommates with the second cousin of a slimy oil magnate. He sounded like a megaphone-equipped activist standing on a soapbox in the town square. It's not like I've got nothing, Trent said, wiping a bead of sweat from his forehead. Between Fiora's dad and mine, I could have gotten a job with at least half a dozen Republicans in this city. But my politics are particular. How so? I asked.
I'm no fan of the Republican Party, Trent said, but I'm no liberal either. There's only one man in the U.S. Senate right now whose views line up with mine. Renaud Cohen. He's an independent, open-minded on immigration and gay marriage, but he's patriotic as hell and has all the right views on the economy. I applied for a job in his office right before I moved here, but I haven't heard anything yet.
Trent sighed, his eyes tired but undeterred. The kind of expression that would go on a billboard for grit.
We'll see if I can find the right connections in the meantime. Every day's a new opportunity to network in this city.
We exchanged numbers at the steps of the hostel. I thanked Trent endlessly for coming to my rescue today. No problem, no worries, don't sweat it, he kept repeating. And I told him to text me if he ever found himself in Philly. Chapter 5. I missed the bus to Philly. I went to bed exhausted Monday night, and I was expecting to wake up feeling equal parts refreshed and displaced. I did not get that luxury. The hostel roomed me with a trio of French backpackers who were shuffling around noisily at the crack of dawn. One of them opened the curtains, inviting a flood of premature sunlight into the room. I pulled the sheets over my face, but light still managed to slip through. Not to mention I could hear the sound of their footsteps. This went on for 2 hours, from about 6 until 8 in the morning. After they left, I fell back asleep and snoozed through my alarm. I woke up 3 hours later. My 9:30 a.m. bus was long gone. I also saw that Trent had texted me.
Hey, man, how much longer are you in town for?
I texted him back. Funny that you ask. I missed my bus this morning. He replied almost instantly.
Aw, I'm sorry, man. That's pretty shitty. When do you think you'll leave now?
Good question, Trent. I put on my thinking cap and ran through my situation. I'd already prepaid for 2 nights at the hostel. I didn't have a grid assignment or an internship to jump into back home. I was feeling exhausted. Verdict? I was in no rush to leave. I guess I'm stuck here till I can get another ticket. Trent replied 15 minutes later. Free for a goodbye drink tonight, then?
Ha!
Part of me wanted to say, what the hell, sure, and make the most of my last night as a runaway. The logical part reminded me that I'd literally met Trent yesterday. He was a nice guy who helped me out, but still, a complete stranger. I played the underage card. You know I'm not 21, right? Kevin and Jack wanted to wait until college to drink. They said it would be less risky when we were on a college campus. And there weren't many parties at Tesla anyway. So none of us drank. I tried convincing Jack to throw a party once when his parents were out of town, but he was too afraid of getting arrested. Fiora would have probably said getting arrested was part of the adventure.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's meet at Thomas Foolery
It's angry hour from 4 to 7. If my age wasn't going to be an issue...
What the hell? Sure.
I looked up Thomas Foolery on Google Maps. It was on P Street, which stemmed out of DuPont Circle, so it wasn't even far. Actually, it struck me that there were a lot of streets coming out of DuPont Circle. 10, to be exact. If you stared at the circle and its surrounding streets, it vaguely resembled a sun, the kind I used to draw as a kid, with a circle and some lines coming out of it. All right, see you at 5. Instead of getting out of bed, I scrolled lazily through my Facebook newsfeed. I was surprised to see Kevin had posted a picture in the middle of the night. He and Jack were jumping in the air outside a massive Chinese pagoda. Caption, "We found Wi-Fi in Wuhan! And a 2,000-year-old tower! Mixing up that old and new, hashtag win, hashtag hot as balls, hashtag China's oven, hashtag SE Asia Youth Leaders Tour." I'd almost forgotten my best friends were off exploring a new continent together, meeting other like-minded kids from around the world. Kevin, the aspiring economist, and Jack, the aspiring diplomat. Compared to them, I felt like an aspiring nothing. It was hard to believe the three of us met in the same globalization seminar freshman year. I never understood how those lessons had such a profound impact on them, yet did so little for me. It might have had something to do with Peggy Zuckerman, the wackiest teacher in a school full of wacky kids. On the first day of class, Mrs. Zuckerman placed an inflatable globe about the size of a basketball on her wooden podium, only to squash it with a thick textbook. "The world is flat," she said crisply. Most of the class exchanged skeptical looks, but Kevin, Jack, and I were sold. We spent our lunch break studying for her human rights violations, pop quizzes, and guessing what antics she would pull next. We relished her peculiar simulations, like the gummy bear arms race. Who would have thought you could demonstrate cultural hegemony and strengthen your friendship with 75 packs of Haribo gummy bears? The three of us appreciated Mrs. Zuckerman's class for different reasons. I found her lessons amusing, while Kevin and Jack were genuinely inspired. Early on, this didn't matter. But lately, as their passion solidified and mine didn't, I felt us drifting. As if it wasn't enough dealing with my own future, I've been having doubts about our future as friends, too. Suddenly, I felt restless. I jumped down from my bunk and threw on my shorts and t-shirt, still damp from yesterday's sweat shower. I didn't want to sit around and keep moping about Professor Mallard, or the bus, or my friends, so I stepped outside to explore this son of a neighborhood. First, I wandered into a bookshop off DuPont Circle called Kramer Books. It was cramped and smelled of burnt rubber, but the books were stacked high and wide, so I stuck around. I picked up a Steve Jobs biography and skimmed the first few chapters. I found it fascinating that the guy dropped out of college, backpacked his way through India, and still managed to build one of the biggest companies in the world. It made me wonder if success was less about grit and more about the journey. I left Kramer Books and walked around the corner to a cafe called Afterwards. Exhausted, I found a table and whipped out my phone. In an effort to exist in a pretend state of stability, I opened a news app called Flipboard. Not because the world was a particularly stable place, but because reading the news was something that stable, level-headed people did. Flip. The situation in the Middle East is bleak. A small terrorist organization, funded by a larger terrorist organization, tore through a village in Syria, killing 290 civilians. 66 were children. Flip. It's worse than I thought. Shit's going down between Israel and Palestine. Flip. Amanda Bynes, Shia LaBeouf. I can't keep track of all these former child stars getting arrested. Flip. Speculation about who's running for president. Flip. Democrat and she's running for president. Flip. Republican criticizes said Democrats' economic policies. Flip. 12 adorably teeny animals that will make your day. Flip. 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 Cecily Mallard explains why grit matters more than talent. I flipped out and knocked over my cup of iced tea. God damn it, I grumbled. Fortunately, there weren't more than a few sips left, and the man sitting next to me jumped in with a stack of napkins. Thanks, I said, smiling half-heartedly. No problem.
he said, wiping away at the liquid. The man appeared to be in his 40s, wearing a tank top and in better physical shape than me. I just saw something that triggered me on this app and freaked out.
Really? What app?
Have you heard of Flipboard? It's one of those apps where you swipe through. The man smiled.
Oh, yeah. I know all about those swiping apps.
Well, I was swiping, and I saw this professor I got rejected by the other day, and... yeah, it was awkward, so I guess I spilled my tea.
Happens to the best of us, he said with a delicate lisp.
He smiled at me again, and I smiled back. We finished wiping down the table, bumping hands twice.
I'm Arnold, the man said. Can I buy you another coffee?
I pondered for a second. That's very,
are you?
Arnold looked at me like I had misled him somehow, and immediately I realized what was going on. I shook my head intensely. No, sorry. He rolled his eyes, strutted back to his table, gathered his things, and left. I was pretty aware of what just happened. I stared blankly ahead as the man made a dramatic exit. When he was gone, I pulled my phone back out.
Flip.
I'd never been hit on by an older person before. He probably thought I was a college student, so I couldn't totally blame him. But it still felt weird. Maybe it felt that way because the man was gay. Believe it or not, I didn't know anyone gay personally. My parents' only friends were other Iranian parents, and they were all straight. At Tesla, there were 7 or 8 out students who were members of the Gay Straight Alliance, but they usually kept to themselves in the physics hallway. My dad used to say people were full of surprises. As I walked over to meet Trent at the bar, I wondered about every person I passed.
Is this woman gay? Is this man a violin prodigy? What if I have a surprise in me?
By the time I reached Thomas Foolery, I realized I'd go crazy if I kept thinking like this. That is, unless I'd already gone crazy. I stepped into the bar, and the city's chaotic soundtrack faded out, replaced by a familiar 90s tune. I Want It That Way, the Backstreet Boys. It wasn't just the playlist. I looked around and realized I had entered a literal playground. To my left, a wall covered in Etch-a-Sketch pads. To my right, an entire corner dedicated to Mario Kart. Leaderboard and all. There were pinball machines, dartboards, and directly under my feet, a hopscotch court. I kind of felt bad for walking right over it. There was no way I was in the right spot. I took a hop and a few steps back outside to double-check the awning. Sure enough, it said Thomas Foolery. I went back inside, hesitant, and took a seat at one of the Etch-a-Sketch tables. I should have known from the name, Thomas Foolery, that it would be a silly establishment. But I thought adults were subtler about these things. I figured they just serve fun drinks, and the bartenders would wear striped bow ties or something. Instead, this place had more Etch-a-Sketches than I could count. I grabbed the one at my table and shook it clean. I turned the right knob, and just like magic, a horizontal black line appeared on the gray screen. Then I turned the left knob, and a vertical line appeared. I turned the knob the other way, and it drew back over the line I had just drawn. This was so cool. Why didn't my childhood involve more Etch-a-Sketches? What if I was on the verge of creating an Etch-a-Sketch masterpiece? This might have been my calling all along, the reason I felt an impulse to run away to D.C. and befriend Trent and end up in this kids-themed bar. Right as I was figuring out how to make diagonal lines, I heard a jingle from the front door. I looked up, and it was not Trent.
Socket?
It was Fiora. Fiora? Is what I should have said. Instead, I said nothing. I looked down at my Etch-a-Sketch and made another diagonal line. She came up and tapped me on the shoulder.
Hello? What are you doing here?
I looked up slowly. Fiora was wearing a black tank top and camouflage parachute pants. At least half her forearm was covered in bracelets, multicolored, beaded, gold, spiked, eccentric, and they jingled as she waved her hand in front of my dazed and confused face. I'm waiting for Trent, I finally said. I was trying my hardest to act calm. Who speaks very highly of you.
I couldn't help that part. What are you doing here?
I'm here to see Trent, too, Fiora said.
That's a weird coincidence. For a second, we were both puzzled, looking around the bar for an eight ball or something with an answer. Then, out of nowhere, Fiora started to laugh uncontrollably.
What?
I asked, kind of annoyed. What's so funny? Fiora kept laughing, bending over to catch her breath.
I never thought Trent had the balls to do something like this, she said.
I think I see what's happening.
So, for what do I have the honor of this blind setup? How'd you even meet Trent?
Fiora suddenly grimaced.
Wait. Are you in love with me?
I rolled my eyes.
Oh my god, you're in love with me, so you tracked down my friend and convinced him to set us up on a date.
Suck it. This is getting out of hand.
You remember my name, I said.
Fiora looked at me with puppy dog eyes and mouth in awe. I shook my head furiously. Wait, no, I'm totally not in love with you, I said, making sure to use an odd number of knots in case she felt like twisting my words.
So what is it then?
Why are we here? She asked, taking a seat at the table. You really can't figure it out, can you?
Nope. I'm stumped. Why did Trent feel the need to trick the two of us into meeting?
Because, Fiora, I emphasized her name because I was about to be blunt, and I wasn't typically a blunt person. You tricked me. Obviously, Trent set up this meeting so you could apologize to me.
Oh, come on, Socket. Don't be dramatic.
No, seriously. Do you see the cuts on my arms and face? I showed her my arms and turned my chin to show off the full extent of my injuries. I got them from the guy you stole that bike from. He chased me all around the city, and I was biking ridiculously, dangerously fast to lose him since I had no fucking clue who he was or why he was after me. And then I finally lost him, but I kept biking and ran into a phone booth, which is where Trent found me in a pool of blood.
Fiora gave me a look.
Fine, maybe it wasn't a pool of blood, but I was covered in blood and cuts and bruises, I said. That's when Trent found me and helped me get cleaned up.
Well, you're welcome, Fiora said smugly.
What?
I gave you your first adventure in DC. You're welcome.
I should have known Fiora would twist my catastrophe into an initiation. What with her free-spirited, life-is-an-adventure-so-carpe-freaking-diem perspective. But it still killed me that she didn't feel even an ounce of remorse.
You're welcome?
I repeated.
Yes, you're welcome. It sounds like I gave you one heck of a joyride. So, what happened to the bike?
I don't care about the bike, Fiora! I burst out. There was a couple sitting at the bar, and you could tell they were trying their hardest not to stare.
You stole it! Do you know what that means? You took something from someone, your teacher, of all goddamn people, and gave it to someone else. That's worse than stealing. That's conning. Technically, he's my boyfriend.
You're dating your... She nodded. Wow, Fiora. I'm past my limit. I leaned in closer and whispered.
What's wrong with you?
Socket, I didn't mean to...
Don't call me that. It's Scott. I don't like it when people call me Socket. Not my friends, not my parents, and especially not you.
My words were sharp daggers, catching even myself off guard. I could see them tearing into Fiora's skin with punishing force.
You were fine with it earlier, she muttered.
Her words trailed off. Fiora, the stranger who could always play it cool and make everything larger than life, had shrunk before my eyes. And you know what? I didn't know what to say, because her shrinking didn't make me feel any bigger. I shouldn't have cared if she used my real name. So we sat in silence for a few seconds and forgot how big or small we were in this world, and especially to each other. The entire bar went quiet. I reached for the Etch-A-Sketch and fumbled around with its knobs to make a diagonal line. Then Fiora spoke.
Look, I can walk out of this bar and forget we ever met. The ball's in your court. Alternatively,
You can accept me for who I am, baggage and all, and how that might rub off on you, or bruise you, or whatever. And we can get a drink.
We?
I can get a drink, she corrected. We can sit here and catch up like sane people. I didn't say anything, but I didn't pick up and leave either. So Fiora, in all her presumptuousness, got out of her seat and walked over to the bar.
Hey, douchebag! She yelled at the bartender. Give me a fucking gin and tonic and a goddamn root beer from my freak of a friend over here.
Fiora, are you all right?
It's angry hour, Scott. You get a dollar off drinks if you order with your finest angry voice.
I giggled the way you're supposed to giggle at a kids-themed bar. It didn't strike me when Trent mentioned angry hour that it would actually be a thing.
Fiora,
I said.
Yeah?
You can use my real name if you want.
Sure thing, Socket.
Chapter 6 Thomas Foolery's business model was simple. Nostalgia. It linked fond memories of childhood to an adult world without rules. You could raise your voice without getting punished. Sketch your night away and erase it with a few shakes or shots. Play pinball on a buzz. Hop some scotch and drink it, too. For better or worse, that strategy was never going to work on me. My childhood sucked. Thomas Foolery brought me back to my worst days, when the playground was a war zone. Like any post-trauma victim, I had blocked most of the memories, but I remembered bits and pieces. The name-calling, for instance. Suck It was by far the most popular. Sucker Punch was a close second. There were plenty of other names. Nerd, wimp, immigrant, terrorist, bookworm, teacher's pet, goody two-shoes. I got made fun of for listening to different music, eating different snacks. I got pushed off the jungle gym by Jack Vance in the third grade. I scraped the mulch off my bleeding arms and legs and looked up at his crew as they snickered, feeling nothing because I'd come to expect it all. I could try erasing my failures, but I couldn't erase my insecurities. Places like Thomas Foolery brought them back in powerful snippets. Just like the flakes of raisin bran I leave at the bottom of the bowl, the shitty parts of my past were always going to stay with me. My life was a clusterfuck of remainders.
I like this place, Fiora said, walking back from the bar with our drinks.
She handed me my root beer and took a prolonged sip of her gin and tonic.
Because it's all gangs.
Fiora leaned in. Her hands were clasped and her fingers interlocked, uncommittedly so, like I could unknot them if I wanted to.
Huh?
I was paying more attention to Fiora's body language than her actual language.
Because it's all games, she repeated. Tom's Foolery is exactly the kind of bar this town needs.
And why is that, Fiora?
People in D.C. treat life so seriously, Fiora moaned. Every day they pretend to make an impact with their entry-level job on Capitol Hill or at a think tank, when in reality, they're just pushing paper. Or worse, they're running the whole fucking office, so they're actually creating more bullshit in the world.
So, politicians?
Not just politicians. Lobbyists, lawyers, quote-unquote think tanks, men, she said, slamming her glass down. Let's be honest, they're all men. They create bullshit at work, and then after work, they make dinner plans and brag about the law they passed, or the pamphlet they wrote, the one only four people will ever read.
I thought about Jack and Kevin, who wanted nothing more than to pass those laws, or write those pamphlets. If only they could have met Fiora.
When they're at work, she continued, they can't wait for dinner. When they're at dinner, they can't wait to get away and go home. And you know what they do at home? This human being who used to read books and play board games and maybe even build model airplanes? They watch the news. The news! They finally have a few hours away from the bullshit of D.C., and they choose to consume the world's bullshit before going to bed and hitting repeat on this whole cycle.
Fiora took another sip of her drink. She fiddled with my Etch-a-Sketch's knob and sighed.
That's why I like this place. It doesn't take itself too seriously.
Okay, I said, smiling. But isn't that what college is for? Being a real person without all the seriousness of the real world? Clearly, you haven't spent any time at GW, Socket. There are two types of people at this school. She tapped two of her fingers on the table. I noticed the bartender watching out of the side of his eye, entertaining himself with the Fiora show. First, you have your future dickheads of America. The political science majors doing Capitol Hill internships. The pre-meds spending all their time in Gelhel.
Gelhel?
Gelman Library. Second, you have your sorority girls and frat bros, who are even worse. At least the future dickheads stress over crap that matters to the outside world. The latest uproar in the Greek community was over a Kappa who wore lime green flats to a Sigma Chi formal. I'm serious. Not figurative, but literal shoes. You've got to give them credit, though, because the almighty Panhellenic Council got involved and promptly squashed the controversy before the Greeks could claim any human casualties. Thank God for authority, right?
Sounds pretty dumb, I said.
Fiora nodded slowly, a bow for her spontaneous monologue. Brava. How am I supposed to pretend like nothing matters, though? I pleaded. These days it feels like every step I take is setting me up for the rest of my life.
Fiora smiled and bounced out of her seat, making her way to the chalkboard. She picked up a piece of chalk and drew a long horizontal rectangle on one end of the board, dividing it into 8 squares.
See this row? She said. This is me.
I walked up to the chalkboard, picked up a piece of chalk, and drew a stick figure with long hair.
This is you, I said. Okay, smartass. Just listen. I'm trying to make a point. Pretend this long row of squares contains all of Fiora Buchanan. Who I am, what I was born with, my brain, my hair, my lips, eyes, everything.
Fiora drew 2 more squares onto the row.
This new column, the one with 3 boxes, that's my parents. They were the first intersection, or rather the first piece of baggage life threw into my grid.
She kept adding new rows and columns, each one intersecting the last.
This one is their divorce. These are all my dad's new wives. This one's summer camp, and here's the junior counselor I ended up kissing there. This one's Trent, a handsome row of squares.
She went on and on with even more squares until half the chalkboard was sufficiently gridded. On the opposite end of the board, Fiora drew another long rectangle and divided it into 7 squares.
This guy is you, Socket.
You have parents, right? Fiora asked.
My eyes leapt. She might as well have asked if they were dead or alive.
Yeah, I said.
Okay, good. Here's your parents, she said, drawing another row that intersected the first one, like a cross, followed by a bunch more rows and columns that intersected. And this is all the other shit in your life.
Fiora drew 1 last row of squares to connect the 2 clusters.
And this, my friend, is where our paths intersected on that bus yesterday.
You drew a crossword puzzle.
Precisely, she replied.
Fiora, the cruciverbalist, conveys the profound metaphor that life is a puzzle, I said, using my finest sarcastic voice. Did Thomas Foolery have sarcasm hour? I deserved a drink special.
No, Socket, I'm just explaining why I don't have my panties in an existential bunch like you.
She moved from the chalkboard back to the table.
Our lives aren't so different from a crossword puzzle, sure. But the thing about life is we don't get to draw the grid. We take the rows and columns we're given. Our bodies, parents, mental health issues, all that. What we do get to do is fill the cells. And rather than filling mine with anxiety over medical school or Greek politics, instead of feeling trapped by my circumstance, I fill them with arbitrary words. An 8-letter word for snowstorm, or a 3-letter word for soda. Silly shit that's true, but doesn't mean anything. I can live with my downs and crosses. I accept the larger truths of my life, but I don't take the cells so seriously.
I accepted Fiora's analysis, even if I wasn't convinced the content of my cells didn't mean anything. We went up to the bar, and Fiora persuaded the couple to join us in a game of Cards Against Humanity. She played some alarmingly disrespectful cards, like the one with Oprah crying into a lean cuisine. I had a few drinks, too, because the bartender got involved and turned it into a drinking game. Then we left.
Cabo,
I slurred. We were back on the street where my bike chase had happened the day before, and I chuckled.
Sunderland Place is very cobbly.
It's not cobble, it's brick, Fiora said. My first alcoholic drink ever. And my second, and my third. I couldn't believe how it happened, where it happened, with whom it happened. It was dark outside. The shades of black and gray and dusky charcoal spun before my eyes. Nighttime befuddled my senses. My feet were floating along. I was too buzzed to feel anything but good.
It's cobble, I asserted.
Brick, socket. Cobble is a sedimentary rock you find in pebble form.
Cobble, I repeated. Cobble, cobble, cobble.
Fiora laughed. Now it just sounds funny. The more you say it, the funnier it sounds.
Funny.
That was a pretty funny word. I wanted to say it again.
Funny, 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 funny.
Stop it! You're stealing all the words! We reached the end of the street. Instead of turning, Fiora grabbed me by the shoulders and looked me straight in the eyes.
Socket? She said in a very play-serious tone. I think you're drunk.
I always thought my first time getting drunk would feel momentous. Like I would savor every sip and wear a permanent grin from ear to ear. In fact, yes, I was grinning. But I think that was from the alcohol, not the fact that I just drank alcohol for the first time. The actual drinking part had been weirdly casual. I didn't think much of it, and I certainly wasn't thinking that a few drinks would get me plastered.
So what's your plan? Fiora asked.
Well, Fiora, it's funny that you should ask. I'm going home tomorrow.
I tripped over my own ankle somehow and nose-planted into Fiora's shoulder. I shouldn't be allowed to get drunk ever.
What happened with that grit professor?
Pah,
I said, unleashing a spray of spit.
She wouldn't even talk to me. I'll never be gritty. No grit material here. Grit. Shit. Maybe if I say it enough times, I'll ruin that word, too. Grit. Grit. Grit.
Fiora cupped her hand over my mouth.
Shush. This is the most ironic wimp out ever.
Tell me what exactly is grit. I sobered up a little.
Perseverance and passion for long-term goals?
Exactly. So go back. Don't let one pathetic no push you away from something you care about.
Believe me, if I did, I wouldn't be writing crossword puzzles or still in a relationship or...
Fiora's words trailed off.
That's the whole point of grit, right?
I stared past Fiora at a red hexagonal sign that said stop. Yes. I was so drunk that it took me a few seconds to piece together the color, shape, and letters of a regular old stop sign. Everything around me was spinning again for the second time that day. I whispered to the sign,
"Fuck you. I'm not stopping."
"What?" Fiora said.
"No, not you. I was talking to...
What time is it?"
"I don't know. Like midnight?"
Shut up. Fiora pulled out her phone.
What?
Look, it's 12:23 a.m.
Let me see that.
I snatched the phone from her hand. She was wrong. 12:24 a.m. It was Wednesday. Professor Mallard held office hours on Wednesdays from 8 to 10 a.m. I had to stay gritty about grit. That was the point. I'd do exactly what she wanted me to do. Even if it was the opposite of what she told me in her office. The reality of my recklessness hit me like a ton of bricks. Fiora had distracted me. I handed her the phone back and took off without so much as a goodbye. I shouted far too many expletives, far too loudly and publicly, as I sprinted down New Hampshire and back to the hostel and made it into my bed, somehow, because it was all a blur after 12:24 a.m. Chapter 7. This time, I knocked first.
Come in, she said.
Her voice sounded distant, thank God, since one cup of spilled coffee was enough. I took a second to check my breath. It wasn't so bad anymore. I woke up that morning with a throbbing headache and some nausea, but the worst offender was the foul stench that had taken over the inside of my mouth.
Ahem. Come in, she repeated.
I twisted the doorknob and pushed before I had the chance to second-guess myself. Professor Mallard was wearing another white blouse, clearly unfazed by Monday's accident. This one even had ruffles. We stood face to face, with 10 feet of narrow office space between us, and her expression immediately dropped. I could feel everything from our last encounter stirring inside me, along with the hangover, but I held my ground. I ignored the stop signs. I locked eyes with her. She raised a finger to speak, but I beat her to the first word. "Hear me out," I said. "I came all the way down from Philadelphia to speak with you. This is important." Professor Mallard crossed her arms and really looked at me. She lifted her chin slowly and assessed my face. I could pinpoint the exact moment when she noticed the fresh cuts under my left eye and against the side of my jaw.
"Remind me of your name?"
"Scott Ferdosi."
"And why, Scott, must you speak with me?"
"I took your grit quiz and failed miserably. I give up a lot. I am 16. I have no passions. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I need your help, you know, to get gritty." Knowing I had a problem was one thing, but admitting it out loud was another. I couldn't bear to look at Professor Mallard as I rattled off my list, so I let my eyes scan her desk in a spontaneous game of spot the difference. The abacus beads had been spread out, and the picture frame with her husband was face down today.
"Have you read my research, Scott?"
"I practically devoured it last week," I blurted. "I'm a bit obsessed with your work." Professor Mallard leaned back in her chair. She took a moment to tie her hair into a tight but ultimately messy bun. Slowly, she faked a smile.
"Then you should be the first to know that a person doesn't get gritty overnight," she said.
"I admire you for making the journey to Washington, and I'm glad you've taken comfort in my findings around grit. But I'm a psychology professor, not a psychologist. I can't help you."
"You can," I begged. "I'm passionate about grit. I'm desperately passionate. Doesn't that mean something?"
Professor Mallard gave me a thumbs up.
"That's wonderful. Call me in a decade when you have your PhD."
"But I failed the grit quiz. What if that doesn't work out?
Scott, have you heard of a growth mindset?"
"You've talked about it in a few of your interviews, yeah. It's the idea that failure isn't a permanent state."
"Precisely. Why would you get hung up over that silly grit quiz? Or anything else you might have failed at? Everybody fails. We deal with failure and disappointment and other feelings that are far more damaging. That's how you grow. Don't go thinking my research will make you grittier. All I've done is prove a few hypotheses. There is no correlation between natural ability and grit. There's a strong correlation between grit and success."
Professor Mallard set the picture frame upright, then immediately picked it up absentmindedly.
"What you need is thicker skin, Scott. Get over your failures and, I don't know, go live your life."
I looked down at Professor Mallard's fingers, which were clutched tightly around the frame in her lap. Something was off. I decided it would be best for me to leave.
"Thanks for your time," I said.
Before stepping out, I added, "I'm sorry if I bothered you. I hope everything is all right." Back at the hostel, I found the door to my room slightly ajar. I opened it slowly and heard the sound of turning pages from the top bunk, not mine, but the other one. I could make out a female of the blonde species lying in the bed, probably one of my French roommates, her face buried in a book.
"Bonjour,"
I said with hesitation.
"Ah, Socket! You never mentioned you spoke French. T'as bien dormi?"
"Fiora." No, my French is pretty crappy." My words slurred and trailed off and generally conveyed a "what the fuck are you doing here" kind of tone. But the more perplexing question, which I actually asked, was, "How the fuck did you get in here?"
It was a breeze," Fiora said.
I complimented the front desk guy on his Ron Paul shirt and chatted him up about some laissez-faire shit. Then I told him I was your sister, and he gave me a room number. Your roommates let me in, the French ones. Real friendly folks. Totally not snobby at all. But I convinced them I was your half-sister, since they actually know you look ethnic-ish, and they let me chill here. Those guys are checked out now, so it's just you and me. I came over to wake up your hungover ass and give you a wet willy or something, but... Hey, Fiora? I climbed up to my own bunk and sat crisscross. This is creepy. Chill out, dude. I just wanted to make sure you were still alive after your first night getting plastered. You know, Fiora, I'm starting to think you might be the one with the crush on me. All right, Socket, you got me. Fiora jumped down from the other bunk and ran up to mine, craning her neck over the railguard. I have a massive crush on you. The sun is actually a huge-ass dandelion, and you, my love, you really kept it together last night. Crap. My memory of Tom's foolery wasn't exactly perfect. How bad was I? Let's just say I had to help you hopscotch your way out, she said. Ugh. I fell over sideways like someone had yelled timber, my legs still crisscrossed and arms covering my mortified face. Out of nowhere, I laughed. You know, Fiora, people aren't like this. Like what? I sat up, clutching a pillow between my arms. Like you. Real people don't give free bikes to strangers and get them drunk and surprise them in their hostel room, I said. You're a caricature of a real person. Do not mansplain me, Fiora snapped. So what? I'm a bunch of different caricatures. You're a bunch of caricatures. This is the one I am right now. You didn't see me in Spain over winter break. You didn't see me last summer when I wrote puzzles obsessively, every day, sometimes multiple puzzles a day. I didn't stop until the Times finally accepted one. I didn't mean it like I know you didn't, she said, her eyes weary. No one does. I've got my shit and you've got yours. We've got our own grids, remember? And just because I don't fit into this perfectly themed grid you have in mind for me, it doesn't mean I'm not real. Well, for a girl who's only taking one class this summer, I said. Fiora's eyes turned fiercely hostile. You definitely just schooled me. Her expression lit up, and we both giggled. So, how'd you spend your first hangover day? Fiora asked. Don't you remember? Remember what? Professor Mallard, I saw her today, I said. That's why I ran off at the end of last night. No way, Fiora said, her eyes wide in disbelief. There's no way you weren't painfully hungover this morning. I shrugged, and Fiora gave me a different look. The best way I could describe it was with an equation. Look equals, open parenthesis, okay, wow, plus okay, fine, close parenthesis, equals okay times, open parenthesis, wow, plus one, plus fine, close parenthesis, is approximately equal to unexpected surprise with eventual acceptance. And you thought I wasn't real, she said. So, how'd it go? Not good. She doesn't want to help me. I think Professor Mallard has some personal shit going on, because she went off on a rant and told me to live my life. I don't want to be an asshole and keep bugging her. Fiora smiled. Why do you even care about grit anyway? I cracked my knuckles and let my eyes wander to the corner of the room, right above where Fiora had been sitting a few minutes ago. A wire stuck out at the edge where both walls met the ceiling. I don't know, I said, staring at that wire. I just do. Everyone cares about random stuff. Like, why do you care about crossword puzzles? Easy. I'm desperate. Well, that's not the best way to promote yourself. Not what I mean, Fiora said, rolling her eyes before focusing intensely on the floor between her two feet. My grandmother used to live in Virginia Beach. We'd drive up from Charleston and visit her when I was really, really little, just me and my dad. Grams lived right off the beach, which was funny because I was terrified of sand, like absolutely scared shirtless. I mean,
Shitless. Ha! Words. Speaking of... Without realizing it, I zoned out and followed the torn wire around the edges of the ceiling. I wondered what would happen if I touched it. How much charge would be emitted through my body? I wondered if the sloppy coat of white paint on the outside of the wire would protect me, or if I'd blow into a million smithereens, my ashes. I stopped myself. I was being rude to Fiora. I tuned her back in. Every morning. It was insane. They were insane. They started each day with a pen and a copy of the New York Times, and 5 minutes later, they had a grid full of answers. I always perched my head over the edge of the breakfast table to sneak a peek. So freaking fascinated by their teamwork. Counting boxes together, passing the pen back and forth. Eventually, they let me join when I was 6 or 7, but I wasn't so good. Not as good as them.
Are you better now? I asked.
Not really. I'm still only a decent solver, Fiora said. But I'm really fucking good at constructing them.
That's so cool, I said. I never realized that people actually, you know...
What?
That there were people who took the time to come up with grids and clues for something as trivial as a crossword puzzle? I guess you could say I'm a bit... puzzled, I said, smiling.
Fiora got up and bolted for the door.
I'm sorry, sorry, I giggled. Bad pun.
Don't pretend you wouldn't love it if I walked out right now.
Oh, come on, I said, shaking my head the way you do in an unreal situation. Anyway, how does all of this make you desperate?
Isn't it obvious?
Her voice crumbled to something more vulnerable.
I'm desperate for answers. Desperate for a connection to my dead grandma. To my dad who fucking sucks now. For complexity with some clarity at the end. For clues.
Fiora went silent. I couldn't even see her anymore. I realized she was sitting directly beneath me on the bottom bunk when I heard the mattress springs creaking with every breath she took.
A lot of things changed after my grandma passed away, she said, almost whispering. My dad got depressed. My mom's drug problems got worse. Turns out all those trips to Virginia Beach were to distract me whenever Mom was visiting her sister. After Grams died, well, you know how these stories go. My therapist keeps trying to connect the dots, but I don't really care. All I know is for some reason or another, I'm desperate to keep doing puzzles, solve them, build them, till the day I die.
I lay on my back and gazed at the ceiling, daydreaming about my parents, who were less complicated, but who would love it if I felt so desperately about anything.
Maybe that's what it takes, Socket, Fiora said. Some massive, life-shifting event to force you into your passion.
Boy, do I hope this is the one.
And if it isn't? Then I'm screwed. My parents will keep pushing me to study medicine or engineering or another safe enough field I have no real interest in.
Fiora began to say something, but she stopped herself at I.
Smithereens. If I touch the wire... I'd blow into a million smithereens. My ashes would scatter along the walls and the ceiling and the floor. The downs and acrosses of this room I existed in.
Chapter 8
One more night, please.
After Fiora left, I went downstairs to pay for another night at the hostel. The lobby was eerily quiet, and the floor creaked as I approached the front desk. Behind it sat the same guy who had checked me in on Monday. He was wearing a fisherman's hat, and his messy brown curls slipped out from underneath.
Just one?
Yeah.
Fiora had convinced me to stay in D.C. a little longer. We agreed to meet later that night at Tonic, a restaurant on GW's campus where Trent worked as a bartender. She promised we would concoct the perfect plan to get Professor Mallard to talk to me and help me get grittier. Personally, I wasn't convinced that Fiora and I would come up with anything game-changing, but what else was I going to do? I couldn't give up in front of her or I'd look like a loser. Besides, I had already quit my internship back home, and without any specific direction from Professor Mallard, I'd have nothing to do around an empty house.
What's your name again? The front desk guy asked.
Scott Ferdosi.
His laptop was turned slightly toward me, and I could see him open an Excel file. There were 4 entries on the entire spreadsheet. Makes sense, I thought. Other than my French roommates, I'd never encountered another soul in that hostel.
That'll be $35, he said.
I pulled out my wallet, handing him my second-to-last 100. He reached under the desk for a tin box and snapped it open.
My name's Scott, too, he mumbled, counting my change.
Cool,
I said. He thumbed through the bills slowly, with intense precision. I stood there tapping my heel. What was one Scott supposed to say to another?
Nice shirt,
I said, because apparently that worked for Fiora. His tight gray V-neck had a massive cartoon of Ron Paul's face with the quote, "There is only one kind of freedom, and that's individual liberty."
Scott perked up. You a fan of Ron?
He handed me $65, and I lingered for a moment.
I am a fan of individual liberty.
Tonic looked like every college bar you see in movies, with a long row of wooden bar stools and flat-screen TVs playing ESPN, and a female bouncer at the door who politely asked for my ID. Yes, my under 21, 20, 19, 18 ID. I froze. Not only because I was embarrassingly underage, but because she was hot. She had wavy strawberry blonde hair with locks draped over her freckled boobs, which were super visible through the low-cut tank top she was wearing. Did I mention that I froze? Fortunately, seconds later, Trent appeared out of nowhere and latched onto my shoulders from behind.
Scotty!
He smelled like a combination of Abercrombie and pot.
Hey, Charlotte, this guy's with me, Trent told the hot bouncer.
We stumbled to the bar, Trent's arms wrapped around my chest and his chin resting on my shoulder from behind like we were old pals.
I always show up exactly when you need me, man.
Trent gestured at an empty bar stool right before sliding under the bar top. I took a seat between a gaggle of girls and a middle-aged man drinking by himself.
Nice shirt, Trent said from across the bar.
I looked down. I was wearing the same Model UN shirt that I had sweated through the other day. I should have felt more embarrassed, but I saw this coming. I'd only packed 2 outfits with me to D.C., and I wasn't going to risk spilling on my polo and corduroys if there was a chance I might see Professor Mallard tomorrow. I had already hand-washed them once after my bike accident. I shrugged.
All right, buddy, Trent began. What are you having? And where's Fiora? She's always late, but it's a Wednesday, and happy hour is all night. The earlier she gets here, the more drinks she can guilt me into pouring for free. You know that girl loves her G&Ts.
Trent would have kept going if I didn't stop him to say, Wait, Trent... Are you high? He shoved a dirty glass into the sink's cleaning contraption and wiped it dry with a rag.
Yep, my man, I am high as a drone. And we both know the Democrats are going to be all over those gizmos to creep on our every friggin' move. Say goodbye to what little privacy you have left, amigo. Unless my man Renaud Cohen does something about it ASAP. Liberal America is making moves, and it's making them fast.
That sounds... I mean, yeah, frickin' drones, I said. I couldn't believe Trent was bartending high, but who was I to judge?
Anyway, man, what have you been up to?
Trent asked. Before I could answer, Fiora marched up and slammed her hands on the bar.
Oh my God,
she gushed, squeezing herself between the middle-aged man and me. He shot her a look.
You won't believe what just happened to me on the corner of F and 21st. This homeless woman came up to my face and pointed her finger like an inch from my nose and goes, You're shit! You know that? And I'm like, What? And she squints her eyes and kind of sways and goes off. You albino, white-haired piece of shit! All of you! You're shittier than shit. You're piss. And then the traffic light changed to walk, and I bolted past her, but not without saying, Well, at least I don't smell like piss.
Then I walked away. Anyway, how are you?